qual più mal vento muta d'acceto e di pensiero, sempre un amabile leggiadro viso, in pianto in riso e menzognero. La donna è mobile, qual più mal vento muta d'accento e di pensier.
La donna è mobile qual piuma al vento. Woman is fickle, like a feather in the wind. When Giuseppe Verdi composed this tune in 1850, he knew he had a hit on his hands, so much so that he gave orders that the tenor who would sing it was not to do so outside of rehearsal for fear he might be overheard. A tune like that could catch on. As a composer, Verdi was already well known, and if it got out before the premiere, the effect would be ruined. The opera in question was Rigoletto, a work that would mark the end of what the composer himself called his galley years, and the beginning of a superstar status equaled in his own field and century only by Richard Wagner. My name is Nicholas Ivor Martin. I'm the director of operations of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and today I am speaking to you about Rigoletto, Verdi's 17th opera. The musical excerpts are from an EMI Classics recording, featuring Tito Gobbi as Rigoletto, Giuseppe Di Stefano as the Duke, and Maria Callas as Gilda. Tullio Serafin conducts the orchestra and chorus of La Scala, and special thanks to EMI for allowing us to use their recording. Audiences today who first hear the Duke's characterization of women tend to bristle, believing that irony was not invented until they were themselves in college. The irony is that Verdi's womanizing Duke is himself a first-class cad. Besides, he's drunk. It's the third act, and he is drunk either with wine or, as he maintains himself, with love. He's trying to seduce the barmaid, who flirts with him by pointing out his own fickleness. As Steve Martin says in his movie Roxanne, "We haven't had any irony here since 83, when I was the only practitioner of it, and I stopped because I was tired of being stared at." In the first scene of the opera, the Duke sings a slightly less famous, but more honest aria, "Questa o quella," in which he explains how much fun he has running after every woman he sees. "La costanza è tirana del cuore," he explains. "Constancy is the tyrant of the heart, and therefore detestable. Tyranny, bad. Never mind that the Duke himself is a tyrant, and that presumably is okay with him." Some of the women in Rigoletto really are fickle. Certainly Maddalena, the barmaid of the last act, is no paragon of faithfulness. She is named after the most famous prostitute in history, but Mary Magdalene was notable for running against type. In that sense, Maddalena may have something in common with her namesake. She runs against type by being one of the few prostitutes in literature who is not faithful with a heart of gold. A more central character is Gilda, the daughter of the Duke's court jester, Rigoletto, and she is so faithful it gets her killed. The second line of La Donna è mobile tells us much more about Verdi's opera than the first. In it, the Duke describes all women as being, quote, "like a feather in the wind," unquote. In the opera, it's all too true. Although Gilda's love and pain can be heart-wrenching, the women in Rigoletto are insubstantial and ungrounded, archetypes or supernumeraries who are blown about by the central male figures. There is no female chorus. Only the male members of the Duke's court get to sing. But this was a common feature of Italian opera and opera companies before 1850. It was, in part, a holdover from church objections to women on stage. But for the many small houses that dotted the Italian landscape, it also meant fewer singers to pay. Actually, Rigoletto was the last opera Verdi would write for only a male chorus. So who are the men moving the action forward? The opera opens in the court of the Duke of Mantua, he of the wandering eye. Rigoletto is his court jester, an acerbic and bitter fool who eggs on the Duke. The Duke is just as interested in the married women as in the single ones? Imprison their husbands on trumped-up charges, Rigoletto advises, and lock them away. The Duke's married male courtiers cannot challenge their sovereign, but they're free to despise Rigoletto, and after that advice, they do. Among themselves, the courtiers agree that it is high time to teach the impudent jester a lesson. Rigoletto scorns them, but he is impressed by Count Monterone, the father of a girl seduced and discarded by the Duke. Monterone has been repeatedly complaining. It has happened so often that Rigoletto and the courtiers laugh and make fun of him when he appears once again. But the Duke is not laughing. He orders Monterone's arrest. Nor does the dishonored Count himself see much humor in the situation. If you put me to death, my ghost will haunt you, he warns. I will return, carrying my skull in my hands and crying to God and man for vengeance.
Esse al carnefice pur mi darete, spettro terribile mi rivedrete. Pur ponte in oro il teschio mio, vendetta chiedere, vendetta chiedere.
Monterone is not exactly the life of the party. Rigoletto is right to be worried about him. Monterone's curse is, as we will see, unusually potent, even by opera standards, although, like the courtier's hatred, it bounces off of the more powerful Duke, expending its full force only on his pathetic court jester. The curse, I want to emphasize, would not have been taken by Verdi's 19th-century audiences as just a literary device. It does indeed foreshadow the final consequences of lust, distrust, and hatred. But Italy in the 19th century was a land in transition. Caught between the tribal city-states of the Renaissance and an awakening scientific modernity, many Italians of the time would not have entirely rejected the idea that a father's curse carried with it some quasi-supernatural power. The curse was important enough to Verdi that he considered using it as the name of the opera. In January 1851, 2 months before the premiere, the working title was still La Maledizione. The curse may have evoked dread in Italian audiences, but it and the entire story of Rigoletto were not originally Italian. Verdi took for his subject a play by the popular French author Victor Hugo. His 1832 play, Le Roi s'amuse, The King Amuses Himself. Hugo's rakish tyrant was a king, not a duke. In fact, he was a specific real-life king, Francis I. Francis spent much of his time trying to counterbalance the power grabs of his contemporaries, Henry VIII of England and Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire. And it was under his reign that the persecution of French Protestant Huguenots began. But Francis was also a true Renaissance king, a patron of the arts who supported artists, rebuilt the Louvre, and composed bad poetry. He also collected women. Francis married twice, maintained 2 successive official mistresses, and a bevy of unofficial ones, the latter grouping at one point including Mary Boleyn, sister of the future second wife of Henry VIII. Francis had a famous real-life court jester, Triboulet, who suffered from microcephaly, a neurological disorder in which a person's head is disproportionately small for his body. Victor Hugo instead made his fictionalized Triboulet a hunchback, a disability that he would recycle the next year in his most famous novel, known in English under the title The Hunchback of Notre Dame. That tells us something about the inspiration for the two central men, but not necessarily about why a 16th-century French king became a 16th-century Italian duke. More on that later. The women in the piece may be feathers blown about by the prevailing wind, but even the men have trouble holding on to their identities. We do not know the duke's name because Verdi never mentions it. After the tumult of the opening scene, we follow Rigoletto home. He's accosted by the sinister Sparafucile, who is trying to drum up freelance work as an assassin. Rigoletto actually considers employing him, but thinks better of it and continues home. Rigoletto's daughter, Gilda, is waiting for the jester. But now we learn that Rigoletto also has an identity problem. A clown and jester by day, at home he is simply Gilda's father. So protective of Gilda is her father that she is not allowed outside of the house except to attend church. She has no idea that her father is a professional clown. She tells us she does not even know his name. Rigoletto will soon discover, like every fairy tale father before him, that locking up his daughter doesn't work. Gilda has met a young student at church and fallen in love with him. And no sooner has she admitted this to her maid than the student, and I say that word in quotes, turns up in the flesh, having overheard the confession. Gilda's suitor is emphatically not a student, but the duke, sniffing about for a new conquest. When Gilda asks his name, he lies and introduces himself as Gualtier Maldet. After they pledge their love and the duke leaves, Gilda goes into pathetic raptures over a name that is no more substantial than the duke's promises. Rigoletto, who has been away from home, encounters the duke's courtiers on his return. They convince him that they are abducting the Countess Ciprano on behalf of the duke and enlist the jester's help. Rigoletto goes along, realizing too late that he has helped them kidnap his own daughter. For the record, the courtiers think Gilda is Rigoletto's mistress. This will be small consolation to Rigoletto, but it solved a problem for Verdi's audience. In a 19th-century opera hierarchy of evil, abducting a man's virgin daughter is much worse than nabbing his mistress. The latter act could almost be passed off as funny, though it certainly does not seem so to modern audiences. Rigoletto's is a dark world, but some shadows are deeper than others. If every shadow were the same, we wouldn't be able to see. The Duke is a thoughtless cad. The courtiers are adolescent pranksters, and Rigoletto is a foolish father who unfortunately thinks he is wise. This question about the morality of it all leads us to answer my other question of how Verdi and his librettist, Francesco Maria Piave, got from a real French king to a fictional one to an unnamed Italian duke. The common thread is censorship. The Italian peninsula in 1851 was just beginning the process of unification. The kingdom of the two Sicilies in the south was still French-ruled. In the center of the proto-country stood the Papal States under Pope Pius IX. In the north were variously Venice and Lombardy, both under Austrian domination, and Piedmont, a liberal constitutional monarchy, and the eye of the coming storm. The summers of 1848 and 1849 saw liberal uprisings throughout Europe. Wagner would have to flee his job in Dresden as a consequence of his own participation in local uprisings. Censors, who had long been part of the European artistic landscape, started themselves looking over their shoulders. With unrest up and down the peninsula, dissent could not be tolerated, much less drama that poked fun at established authority. Victor Hugo wrote his play about a philandering 16th-century monarch in 1832, but the French censors believed he was talking about a contemporary monarch, Louis-Philippe of France. They allowed a single performance and then promptly shut it down. Hugo made himself notorious by suing to have the judgment overturned, but he lost. The play would not be allowed on stage in France for another 50 years. By choosing such a controversial play, Verdi and Piave were taking a chance. They had been commissioned to produce an opera for Venice's opera house, La Fenice, for the 1851 carnival season. Piave was sure he could get a script approved, and so convinced Verdi. As it turned out, he was very nearly wrong. For the opera, the censors would have nothing to do with Victor Hugo's title, even though the composer liked it. It was still internationally notorious because of the scandal around the opening and the ongoing lawsuit in France. Nor could they tolerate a philandering king, any king, French, Italian, or Swedish. Piave substituted a duke, but even this was thorny. Many 16th-century dukes had living descendants, some of them still in power. Piave settled on Mantua because while everyone knew that 16th-century Mantua was the fief of the Gonzaga family, the main Gonzaga lines had died out 150 years before. There would be no heirs glowering at the opening performance. Nor was politics the only stumbling block with the Austrian censors. In Act II, Rigoletto returns to the palace desperate to get his daughter back. The courtiers bar his way, and he is not reunited with her until after the Duke has either seduced or raped her. Rigoletto swears to revenge this insult, but Gilda begs her father to spare the man she still considers to be her lover. Censors were also concerned with morality, and Piave's early drafts for a libretto challenged them. This act, in which we know that the Duke is behind the upstage door violating Gilda, her name is Blanche in the Hugo play, was not an easy sell. The censors likewise objected to the opening of Act III. In the final version, the Duke has come to Sparafucile's house hoping to seduce his sister, the saucy Maddalena, with his catchy song heard at the beginning of the commentary. But this was a compromise. For Hugo, the seduction of Maddalena had already occurred. The Duke was going to the house to continue an established liaison. Rigoletto uses the Duke's assignation to try to prove to his daughter how unworthy the Duke is of her, but without success. A masterful quartet ensues, with the Duke trying to seduce Maddalena and Rigoletto trying to talk sense into his daughter.
Bella figlia
contrast to the relatively simple music of La Donna Mobile, reminiscent of the composer of Ernani and Macbeth, this quartet is that of a composer embarking on some of the most complex and important work of his career. 2 years after Rigoletto's successful opening in 1851, the composer would unveil both his Il Trovatore and La Traviata. Ballo in Maschera, Forza del Destino, Don Carlo, Aida, Simon Boccanegra, and ultimately Otello and Falstaff, would follow over the next 40 years. Verdi's apprenticeship was over. He was now the undisputed standard against which all Italian opera would be judged. Rigoletto's words fall on deaf ears. Gilda is in love. When her father pays Sparafucile to kill the Duke, Gilda decides to intervene. Dressed as a man to facilitate her and her father's planned escape from town, the young girl knowingly walks into the house so that Sparafucile will kill her instead of the Duke. She succeeds. Sparafucile puts the mortally wounded Gilda into a sack and gives it to Rigoletto, who gloats over his triumph. The censors were particularly put out by the sack. "People may laugh," they warned. "In any case, it's in appalling taste." The composer was livid. "I do not understand why they have taken away the sack," he wrote to La Fenice. "What difference does the sack make to the censor? Are they afraid of the effect it has? But I allow myself to say, why do they think they know more about this than I do? If you take away the sack, it is unlikely that Rigoletto would talk for half an hour to a corpse without having a flash of lightning show him that it's his daughter." A good point. Fortunately for us, Verdi, with much help from La Fenice, won the day. In the midst of his illusory triumph, Rigoletto hears the Duke happily singing his hated song. He tears open the sack to discover Gilda, who explains she is happy to die for her lover. She expires in her father's arms. The jester realizes with horror that Monterone's curse has struck him down.
Gilda, mia Gilda, è morta!